From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was reached sometime Sunday afternoon when state lawmakers in Albany reached a broad budget agreement. And in that agreement, there is, apparently, a deal on ethics reform. After the arrest of longtime Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver earlier this year, there have been questions about whether lawmakers should be allowed to make big money through outside income. This ethics deal has been aiming to curb that practice and make it more transparent. But the proposals have been filled, at least some of them, with loopholes, as reporters across the state have been detailing. Lawmakers would not be allowed to use campaign funds to buy personal items, but they would be allowed to use campaign funds, to pay for criminal defense. Good government groups have been arguing that this is just one example of how the ethics proposals are falling short. So will this plan have real teeth? Will it cut down on the kinds of scams described recently by U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara? As Capital New York reporter Bill Mahoney tweeted this morning, quote, "This ethics reform agreement will be Albany's third in less than 4 years," end quote. And this time, they swear they're serious about it. We're going to hear from a number of reporters this hour. But first, I want to check in with Karen DeWitt, who is our Capital Bureau correspondent in Albany. Karen, as always, thanks for taking the time.
Sure thing.
All right. So late yesterday afternoon, last night, we heard the word of a deal here. Is it done?
Well, they have a habit of, you know, almost finishing a budget and putting out a press release taking credit for finishing the budget. But we got very few details last night. To his credit, the new speaker, Carl Hastie, gave us some comments about some of the arrangements with teacher evaluations and things like that, which the governor's office then overnight contradicted. So it's a little confusing. And as far as I know, the bills have not actually been printed yet. So we are wondering how this new teacher evaluation redesign is going to be structured. What is exactly in the ethics reform? We know there's going to be partial disclosure of lawmakers' outside law clients where they work at their private firms, but we don't know all the details of that. So it's still somewhat in flux. I mean, at least they know that, you know, they pretty much have agreed and they're going to get it done on time, and so they wanted to take credit for that and, you know, have some good news out on Monday morning.
I don't recall the last time I saw this heated a debate, for example, on education funding and education reforms, and yet when a budget gets done, all sides are claiming victory. There seems to be some dissonance there.
Well, that's kind of typical. I mean, I think that's the only way you can get a budget deal is give everybody a little something and then all declare a victory, sometimes before anybody can scrutinize it too much. And you mentioned the kind of the vitriol. It's because Governor Cuomo really did pick a fight with the teachers union. I mean, he has his reasons. He says there's failing schools, there's bad teachers, and, you know, he says that it's hard to get rid of the bad teachers, it's hard to fix the failing schools. But, you know, teachers really took offense, and the union is well-funded, and they did ads, they've done rallies. I think there's about 19 billboards, I was told, on highways all around the state capitol here leading in and out, and they all have a very unflattering giant photo of Cuomo with a negative message. So that really made everything more fractious.
As always, Karen, wiser than I am, I think you're right. I mean, the vitriol, yes, but allowing everyone to say we've won can maybe satisfy whatever base you're going back to. It will be interesting to see exactly the details there. What other questions do you still have on your mind that you want answered over the next 24 to 48 hours, Karen?
I guess some of these probably can't be answered until the session plays out, but all of the issues they dropped, the DREAM Act, raising the minimum wage, the education tax credit, I could go on and on naming a whole laundry list. Are those going to be passed before the session ends in June, or has the governor really lost his leverage now that he was forced to drop them out of the budget? So it's sort of, there's going to be a very busy post-session, and I guess my question is, are they going to be able to tackle these issues one by one and get any of them passed, you know, absent now this big budget deal?
Karen, sometimes there are either interest groups or segments of the community that are passionate about issues, but it's hard to tell if lawmakers are truly as vociferously on their side. So when it comes to, for example, minimum wage, do we know who is going to feel sold out if that doesn't happen? Who's really pushing for higher minimum wage in Albany?
Well, the kind of progressive movement, the Working Families Party that's allied with a lot of the Assembly Democrats, the unions, of course, because, you know, this is probably cynical to say, but if the minimum wage goes up for the workers at McDonald's, then union workers with better jobs, that pushes everybody's wage up. So there's a, you know, there's a benefit there for them. And, yeah, I think it would probably, you know, further deteriorate some of Cuomo's relationships with the unions. But you also have the Senate Republicans who are in control of the Senate, and they're answerable to the conservative party and their base who, and some of the bigger businesses who don't want to do it.
Karen, we'll let you go, and I'm sure we'll be looking for your reports this afternoon and over the next couple of days as they get all of the details done.
Well, I do hope to have more details later today. Let's cross our fingers.
That is Karen DeWitt, our Albany Bureau correspondent. And now that we've seen the broader landscape of what we do know and what still is unanswered when it comes to this budget deal, let's zero in on ethics reform with a number of people who've been following this closely. In studio with me is Catherine Smith of the League of Women Voters, the Rochester metro area, and a frequent guest here. Catherine, nice to see you.
Thank you for inviting us.
And right now, on the line, we've got a couple of reporters who've been diving into this over the recent months. That's Joe Spector, Albany's Bureau, the Albany Bureau Chief for Gannett. Joe, thanks for taking the time.
Hey, Evan, thanks for having me.
Bill Mahoney is here as well. Bill is a reporter for Capital New York who's been reporting on this issue. Bill, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Joe, let me start with you, and we'll hit Joe and Bill. Before we get to what the League of Women Voters and other interest groups, for example, the New York Public Interest Research Group is going to join us later this hour, we've been hearing what people want when it comes to ethics reform. Joe, what do we know, or at least what do we suspect is going to be there when we get the final details over this coming week?
Well, certainly it starts with greater disclosure of lawmakers' outside income. That's something that the governor has honed in on here, particularly after the arrest of then-Speaker Silver on January 22nd for allegedly getting $4 million in kickbacks from two law firms. After that, Cuomo said he wouldn't sign a budget that didn't have ethics reform, particularly lawmakers disclosing more about their outside income. But as you said, we're still waiting for all the details on that. You know, some good government groups today say, wait a minute, it's going to be greater disclosure of clients, but in some cases, lawmakers, particularly those who are lawyers, you know, sometimes they don't have clients. You know, they're there working for the firm. They do some consulting work, whatever the case may be. So they might not have clients. So how will this get at, you know, what they do for the money?
Yeah, Joe, Brian Kolb is going to join us later this hour. He's talked about his distaste for the practice of rainmaking, as he puts it. And his concern is that this will not be addressing rainmaking at all.
Well, that goes to the larger point. You know, even the governor, when he first outlined his plans, he said perhaps the cleanest way to get about this would be to just put a ban on all outside income. You know, some have said ban outside income altogether, raise their pay, and then you're done with it. Or put a cap on pay, as in Congress. In Congress, you can only make 15% more than your government salary on the outside. So, you know, short of the any cap. The best they could do is more disclosure, and that's what they're trying to address here.
All right, and Bill Mahoney has reported on possible loopholes for Capital New York. Bill, when it comes to the outside income, there is an important number we've been hearing about, $5,000 as a threshold. Where do you see that going, and give me a sense for if that's in this proposal, if that comes out in this deal. That $5,000 baseline could easily be circumvented based on your reporting, if I understand it correctly. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, at least in the budget that the governor initially proposed, legislators only needed to disclose their clients if they paid them more than $5,000 in a calendar year. We don't know if that's changed at all because, as Karen and your other guests have mentioned, we haven't actually seen final language yet. But under that, they didn't require... $5,000 is still a bit of money in itself. We have seen one legislator get arrested 2 years ago for collecting a $5,000 bribe, so it's not unimaginable that somebody could be influenced by a $5,000 payment from somebody. But at the same time, there's really nothing to aggregate different $5,000 contracts that somebody signs with one client. For example, one of the clients that came up in the Sheldon Silver arrest was Leonard Litwin, who's perhaps New York's biggest campaign contributor by most measures over the past decade. He gives over $1 million each year routinely, but he gives through a bunch of different corporate holdings that he has, and each of them gives campaign contributions, so he's able to circumvent campaign contribution limits that way. And if somebody like him really wanted to funnel a lot of money to a legislator, they could sign 12 different $5,000 contracts with them each year and still find a way to pay them $60,000 and never see that disclosed.
I would think that there's plenty of firms that could come up with a couple of dozen people to pay $5,000 or less, and that's a pretty easy way to make six figures if you really want to. So, Bill, why not? Why have a threshold at $5,000 at all? Why not total disclosure?
I think you would have to ask the governor's office for that one. There are other states that have lower disclosure. Like, I believe Connecticut has $1,000, and there's a few other states that just have all that have much stronger limits for what needs to be disclosed. But that's what we have. At least that's what we know that we have. We don't know if that's changed.
Sure.
That's what that shows, and that seems like that's what we're going to be going with.
But Joe Spector, the governor, has been saying that this could be the strongest ethics reform in the land. And I'm wondering, when we start to look around at these possible loopholes, and comparatively, whether we're looking at Congress on the federal level, other states, does it make sense to say that this would be the toughest or most stringent?
Well, that's the question here. I mean, you know, I think one of the things that their argument is that no matter how many laws you put on the books, people could always find loopholes and ways to skirt them. And if you, you know, increase transparency and make these things public, then, you know, people could ask more questions about, well, what do you do for the money? You know, it was only a few years ago that the public couldn't even see what lawmakers received an outside income. You'd get the ethics disclosure forms. It would say, you know, a lawmaker worked for firm X, and then the salary piece of that was blacked out. You couldn't see it. So, I mean, there has been improvement in transparency, but the question is, you know, is this the package that's going to really step up and, you know, make it clear what lawmakers do for their outside income?
We have a few minutes with reporters Joe Spector, the Albany Bureau Chief for Gannett, and Bill Mahoney, a reporter for Capital New York. Bill, if the reporting, that you've done on these proposed reforms does turn out to be exactly what we're looking at this week, is there a reason to at least say that what Sheldon Silver is alleged to have done could not be done again?
Well, I don't think it would make any difference in the Sheldon Silver case. Silver was already, if these allegations against him are true, he was already required to disclose the fact that he was making money from a second law firm, but he made it a decade without their name ever appearing on his ethics disclosure forms. And I think, and there's no reason to believe that he would suddenly start disclosing his clients under this bill if he never disclosed the fact that he even worked for this firm in the past. A lot of that probably gets to enforcement in Albany. We've got the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, which was created by Governor Cuomo's ethics reform in 2011. That's come under a lot of criticism in recent years for not really being as active as other enforcement agencies like the U.S. Attorney's Office in terms of digging into Albany legislators and auditing their filings. And this proposal doesn't make any changes to how JCO operates.
Joe, when it comes to the way lawmakers are allowed to use their campaign funds, there have been questions about that. The reporting we've seen indicates that this ethics reform will prevent lawmakers from using their campaign funds for personal items, but it would not, at least from what I've seen, it wouldn't stop them from using their campaign funds for legal defense. That's been a sticking point for a lot of people. Am I wrong about that? Has that moved?
No, that appears to be not included, the idea that they could use it for legal defense. The governor last week, when he was asked about it, indicated that that would remain their ability to do so. He made the argument that it would protect lawmakers or even, you know, him as governor, the ability to use their legal defense, use their campaign cash for legal defense funds. And so, yeah, that's a big issue. I mean, you have an issue right now where the state has to pay back millions of dollars to former Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno because he was found not guilty in a case. He wants the money back that he had to put up for that, and much of that came from his campaign. So the state's essentially is going to be paying back his campaign for the money he spent on his legal cases.
Before I let you both go here, Catherine Smith from the League of Women Voters Rochester Metro Area, why don't you jump into this conversation and let us know, as you have not only tried to consume this reporting and understand what's happening, but what has the League wanted when it comes to real reform? What would be real ethics reform in your mind?
One of the items that you've been discussing today are what possible changes may be in this budget regarding how people conduct themselves. But the League has strong positions on those. But we also have very strong positions on the enforcement, even if there's disagreement about what the actual ethics rule or regulation is. There are several things with Jacob that we would like to see changed, and we have not heard discussion of that. And as far as I know, that's not in this budget proposal. We're talking about things, the agency, just to have the money to report electronically so people know what they're doing and what their findings are. And we didn't see money to increase that for the agency, staffing and updating equipment and those kind of everyday things that need to be done. Real quick things about JCO, the majority vote they have, who appoints them, how that gets reported. And a very large item the league believes is when it gets reported. It can be 45 days after, and then there's another provision where it can be another 45 days. By that, sometimes, you know, citizens of aren't keeping track of it any longer 3 months later, and they're no longer in session. So one of the things with the updating of equipment and the addition of staff would be, we are asking that that reporting be done within 10 days so that we can follow these cases more carefully.
Are you disappointed in what you've seen proposed, at least in so far reporting and perhaps what we'll see this week?
The league firmly believes that a lot of the major items need to be done, and they need to be done together. There are two or three others besides the operations of JCO. The ethic reporting, there's one for legislative, and they have a legislative ethics committee. There's one for the executive. There's one for the lobbyist. We feel that the standard should be applied to the people that are making the laws and enforcing the laws in the state of New York.
Joe and Bill, let me read real briefly before I let you guys go here a couple of comments. In fact, let's go back to three different comments from Governor Cuomo. 2013, the summer of 2013, when the governor rolled out the Moreland Commission, he called it a legal all-star team that would be independent, that could make recommendations and look for corruption wherever the trail led. Of course, we know that in March of 2014, he disbanded that commission much more quietly. And then in July of 2014, so a year after he launched that commission, he was responding to a question about the disbanding of Moreland and the failure to enact ethics reform. And the governor said, quote, "The Moreland Commission was created to produce a set of ethics reforms, and it did. And we have bribery laws that we never had before. We have more disclosure than we ever had before. The Moreland Commission was a phenomenal success. It generated all sorts of interest in the behavior of the legislature." Then, February of 2015, speaking at New York University last month, Governor Cuomo said, quote, "Corruption in Albany will reoccur unless we have total disclosure that leaves no question unanswered and brings sunlight to the ethical shadows." Bill Mahoney, you tweeted this morning, this would be the third ethics reform package in 4 years, and it's hard to look at this and know if we're supposed to take it seriously, because it's the same kind of language. Every year it's kind of the same self-congratulatory language, and I know that was kind of what you seem to be poking a little fun at that in your tweet this morning.
Yeah, this comes up pretty much every year to varying degrees, at least under Governor Cuomo, and it's tough to know when will be the ethics reform that really reduces corruption in Albany, that will reduce the number of arrests we see going forward. I don't think we'll be able to cast an absolute judgment for some time down the road, but it is something we've heard before, where there's pretty much every year a kumbaya of some sort about them either passing ethics reform or redistricting reform, but it's tough to say that things have changed a lot in the past decade, and we've seen more arrests. We've seen more legislators get exposed for various scandals and brought down. Whether or not that's just because people are more aggressive about going after things like bribery and sexual harassment, or whether or not the problem is increasing, that's difficult to say. But as you've mentioned, yes, we've certainly been there before.
Joe Spector, when I hear the governor last summer say the Moreland Commission was created to produce a set of ethics reforms, and it did, it was a phenomenal success, and then 6 months later, he's talking about the need for total disclosure, and if we don't have it, then we will continue to see corruption in Albany. I'm wondering how you get from one point to another in 6 months there. Does that strike you as odd in any way?
Well, it's the circumstances. I mean, you know, his comments came just days after the Speaker of the Assembly, who had been the Speaker since 94 was arrested on corruption charges over something he'd been doing for a decade or more. So, I mean, the governor and legislative leaders had to respond to that. They had to come up with something to say that they were going to be responsive to what happened to Silver and to others. I mean, the Moreland Commission, you know, the question here has been, as the League of Women Voters says, you know, is that who's the enforcer? I mean, it was supposed to be Jay Cope, which the governor started in 2011. And it's turned out that it's federal prosecutors who are the ones who are handling these cases. I mean, should it be federal prosecutors, or should it be the ethics board that the state set up to try to root out a lot of the corruption here?
And Joe, last question for you, and I'll kick the same way to Bill here. When the governor says that the Moreland Commission, what happened with the Moreland Commission, he's almost indicated that he thinks it should deserve credit for leading to the cascade of events that we've seen this year, Sheldon Silver's arrest, the new ethics reform proposals. Does that logically follow that there's a cause and effect, Joe?
Well, his point has been whatever the Moreland Commission came up with, it would ultimately end up in the hands of prosecutors, whether it was Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney, or DA, because those would be the people who could prosecute any malfeasance that was found by the Moreland Commission. Critics say, well, why would you close up the Moreland Commission? They were doing good work. Why not let them complete what they started and then, you know, see what they have? There'd be a list of recommendations, be a variety of steps that could occur because of the Moreland Commission before it was shut down.
Bill, what do you think?
Yeah, and I think one point, I agree with everything Joe said, but one point to add to that is the Moreland Commission was never just about getting people arrested or putting more people in handcuffs. It was about trying to understand how Albany really works and what the problems might be. And we even saw in their preliminary report, there were anecdotes that they pulled out that nobody had ever heard before. And they were painting a pretty solid portrait, it seemed, of how a lot of these backroom dealings happen in Albany. And after another year to complete their work, it seems reasonable to assume that they would have painted a much fuller portrait. But that was never concluded. So it's tough because part of what they were aiming for was a true understanding, a public understanding of what went wrong, which might lead to better ideas for fixing problems in the future.
Earlier this hour, we had a chance to talk to our Capitol Bureau correspondent, Karen DeWitt. She always does great work for us, and the two gentlemen who've taken some time for us this hour are doing remarkable work as well. Joe Spector, the Albany Bureau Chief for Gannett, thanks for sharing some time with us, Joe.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Bill Mahoney, reporter for Capitol New York. Great work there, Bill, and certainly we'll stay in touch with you guys as we learn more about what is really in this budget. Thank you, Bill.
Great. Thank you.
Let's get a short break. We're going to come back and talk to Blair Horner, who is the legislative director for the New York Public Interest Research Group, and continue our conversation as well with Catherine Smith of the League of Women Voters in the Rochester metro area. We can get your phone calls in on ethics reform and your questions on Twitter at Evan Dawson, or call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Very short break, and right back on ethics reform on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about publishing a novel, how to get published, how to make your first work a breakthrough success, and what to do with it. Boris Fishman is the author of A Replacement Life, an acclaimed novel, a fictional look at Holocaust reparations and the toll it takes on a family. He's coming to Rochester, but first, he's on Connections next hour.
One eighth grade teacher in Nashville is part of a bold new experiment.
The weight of this 100 students is on my shoulder, but I have a team that is strong enough where I say, hey guys, we gotta get this done. They follow me.
Putting great teachers in charge of other teachers and other classrooms. That's later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It appears, with the almost certainly imminent passage of a New York State budget this week, that ethics reform is part of that. And as you've heard from the various reporters joining us this hour, we still need to get the details, the specifics. But a lot of those proposed details have been in the media for recent weeks, and we've had a chance to get a look at them, and it does look like there are some loopholes, and you've heard those described. Whether it's a $5,000 reporting threshold, which would allow someone to have, you could have 25 clients or 25 outside interests paying you $4,000 a piece, you're making six figures, and all of a sudden you can get around disclosure laws. And if that sounds outlandish, it is not. That is certainly something that can be done. That would be in place going forward. You could have a situation where lawmakers are allowed to pay for legal defense with their campaign funds, even after all this time. That's another complaint. So there's a number of questions going forward. We're going to hear from Brian Kolb in a moment, but let me bring in Blair Horner, who's the legislative director for the New York Public Interest Research Group, who's on the line with us as well. Blair, thank you for taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me, Evan.
We're all trying not to be cynical, and Catherine Smith and I were just talking about during the break, and I said, you know, it's not a healthy feeling to be cynical, but you look at three straight years of sort of chest-thumping about great ethics reform, tough ethics reform. Now the governor's office saying some of the toughest and most stringent in the country with regards to outside income and other things. Do you buy it? What do you make of it?
Well, I definitely get the feeling that as the geese head north, there's another ethics package that passes Albany. The package, and I think part of the problem with this package this year is that the governor is, again, we haven't read the bills yet, so
right.
We don't know for sure, but based on what we've seen in the past and what has been discussed, the governor sort of is overhyping the achievements that are in the ethics package. As we understand it, for the first time, lawyers will have to disclose, and other professionals will have to disclose their clients in some, but not all, circumstances. And so that's an achievement. Is it the best in the country? Well, again, the devil will be in the details, but my sneaking suspicion to that is that the answer will be no, that there'll be other states that have broader disclosure requirements. And so I think what fuels sometimes public cynicism about these deals is they get oversold in the public arena, and instead of saying we're making incremental progress, we get rhetoric like strongest in the country or the best on the planet.
But Blair, you know, I think when we hear this discussion about an ethics deal, quid pro quos, it can feel at times like what's going on in Albany is a real-life version of House of Cards. I mean, it feels like you've got Kevin Spacey walking around, you know, the halls of Albany, saying that, you know, everybody has something that somebody wants and everything has a price. And I don't, you know, and I'm trying not to be, to make that assumption, but give me a sense for the landscape that you see. Are quid pro quos common? Is influence peddling common?
No, I guess the short answers to both are yes. The one big distinction between House of Cards and Albany would be, I don't think anyone up here would ever, like, murder someone with their bare hands, which is where House of Cards sort of goes off the rails.
Yes.
But in Albany, there have been enough lawmakers convicted of unethical behavior or pay-to-play activities that we know it happens. And what has been the problem, I think, in Albany is what has been allowed to legally occur in some ways is worse than what is illegal. And so I think what the governor is attempting to do with his, you know, his effort this year is to ratchet down on what is allowed behavior. And, you know, we've been very critical of this. I don't want to be in the position of defending the governor, but certainly what will likely come out of this package when we actually read the details is going to be incremental changes in disclosure requirements and penalties, but it all, in our view, is built on a house is built on a sand foundation. It's a castle built on foundation of sand, because the enforcement side of this is really not dealt with. And what fuels my cynicism is, under New York law, the governor and the legislature were supposed to appoint an independent panel last year to review the ethics watchdogs in the state, and they just blew off the requirement. And now they're going to say, well, we're appointing a commission to look at it. But had they done that last year, they might have been able to make some informed decisions this year about how to improve enforcement. And that's a huge problem in Albany, the lack of independent enforcement. We should not have to rely on the U.S. Attorney's Office to enforce state ethics requirements.
But Blair, again, as Joe Spector pointed out, the governor has said that even if it's in a U.S. attorney's hands, it was his decision to create a Moreland Commission that was the first domino that led us here. And at least those dominoes have started to fall. That's better than nothing.
Yeah, I know, but the governor also said that the Moreland Commission was going to follow without, was going to act independently and follow without fear or favor the trail. And what we found out was the executive, the governor's office, was influencing where the Moreland Commission could investigate. And then the governor pulled the plug on them last year on another unsatisfying ethics deal as part of that deal. So, and we also learned that the grand jury that was looking into the speaker, then Speaker Silver, was convened prior to the Moreland Commission even being appointed. So I'm sure that the evidence that the Moreland Commission found and that was seized by the U.S. Attorney's Office probably is helpful to the U.S. Attorney's Office. But to say to the public that you're going to convene a panel and let them roam where they need to roam independently and enforce the law and then pull the plug on it, I think that that undermines any claim of the importance of their work.
Catherine, is that a fair criticism?
And I think there are two other things, Blair. As you pointed out, in 2014, the outside review panel that was required by law, that was passed last year, required that the government appoint, and he hasn't done it. It's, you know, been over a year and the appointments haven't been made. And the other thing, in the 2014 agreement, there were new powers given to the Chief Enforcement Counsel. But what the League believes, and I believe other groups concur with this, is that you also need a concurring judicial from the Attorney General's office, that you need to have that outside, independent, legal opinion on these cases.
Okay, well, go ahead, Blair. Yeah, go ahead.
Just to sort of add to it, I mean, you know, the big problem in Albany is taxpayers in New York are spending millions of dollars for state-based ethics and campaign finance enforcement entities. And there, at the moment, is the public should be very skeptical that these entities act independently and follow the law without fear or favor. And until that changes, nothing changes. We all, when we drive on the thruway, know there's a speed limit that's posted on the road. We all know what we do when we see a speed trap. And the problem in Albany is the lack of essentially ethics speed traps along Albany's highway.
So, Blair, Catherine has said that it's important for the League of Women Voters not just to look at a proposal and feel like that's not going to work, we'll criticize, without offering some constructive ideas as well. We've been hearing from her on some of those specific ideas. In a moment, we'll get Brian Kolb's ideas on what could be done. You've talked about enforcement as a big point, but where does NYPIRG come down when it comes to what is viable and maybe what is attainable, whether or not it gets done this week? Well, what do you think should be done?
Well, I mean, you know, the governor announced last night a deal with the legislative leaders. Presumably the deal is done, even though it was concocted in secret, and the governor is going to issue a message of necessity because it's such an emergency that it has to pass in one day, right? I mean, the whole sort of setup on this thing means that there'll be no real public scrutiny of the deal. We put out a report last month where we identified what we thought the solution on outside income should be. I mean, the problem we have is lawmakers are too often using the public office for private gain. But Congress dealt with that in the post-Watergate era by saying there's going to be a cap on how much money you can make in your outside occupation. That would reduce the likelihood that someone would allegedly take millions of dollars in kickbacks and bribes to influence public decisions. So that, we think, is the model that New York should be facing, that when you go down this disclosure route, although disclosure is important, it's very difficult to come up with a system that is not without flaw, and that you really need to sort of cap outside income, make lawmakers focus on the job at hand, and when they're in Albany, they serve one master, not two, and that master is the public.
And Blair, right on cue, Scott on Twitter wants to know, what is Congress's limit on outside income?
It's roughly 15% of the highest paid salary in the congressional branch, the legislative branch of Congress. And that works out to roughly $27,000 is the cap that a lawmaker in Congress can make on the outside.
Okay. Blair, can you stick around? Can we listen to some of Brian Kolb's comments? Because I'd like to get your feedback on this as well.
Sure.
You have a few more minutes here. Let's listen to this. I had a chance this morning to talk to Brian Kolb. He is the minority leader of the Republicans in the New York State Assembly. He has been critical of some of what we're hearing. Let's listen to Brian Kolb's thoughts on what we do know, what we don't know, and what he would like to see when it comes to ethics reform. Mr. Kolb, as always, thanks for taking the time. Welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure.
All right, so we're hearing that the deal is still sort of being hammered out. What is still undecided when it comes to, for example, ethics reform? What is done and what is not done?
Well, in terms of they've announced an agreement about ethics reform, but there are no bills in print, which means there's no details about what they've agreed to. A lot of rumors, no specifics. And until the whatever agreement that they reached verbally goes into actually a printed document, everything is very fluid and subject to change, because even when it gets into print, that's where the devil's in the details in terms of how it, whatever they've written up, how it would be implemented or executed. And so right now, all we're really dealing with is rumors and not concrete hard evidence as to what the ethics legislation consists of.
We've seen reports of proposals in recent weeks. We've also heard varying reports about possible loopholes, even with, say, a $5,000 threshold, for example. Are you concerned about loopholes? Tell us about that.
Well, certainly I think any piece of legislation when you're dealing with ethics reform, there's always a concern about loopholes, especially when you're dealing in the legal community. That's what lawyers are paid to do, which is find loopholes in the law to exploit or to avoid. And so that's why it's very important to read the actual legislation and decipher what has actually been put in print and how tight whatever the provisions are. Are there loopholes? Is there an opportunity to go around them or find a way to have an opportunity to usurp them? So that's always a question. That's why we have extensive debate on the floor, and we have briefings, and when this information becomes concrete, to really try to find out and establish how solid it is, or maybe how not so solid the new law is.
And I think that's where I'm trying to go with this. Do you get the sense that this is real and tough ethics reform, the way it's being touted by the governor and his office, or do you have a concern that this is another watered-down or easily sort of circumvented set of constraints that won't be real reform?
Well, my concern is it won't be real reform. Will there be some changes compared to what we currently have? I'm sure that there are. But certainly I think that, Albany has been very reluctant to really change its ways overall. Even in our house in the State Assembly, we've proposed reform bills in how the Assembly governs itself. We actually have had a Public Officers Accountability Act, which deals with reforms for both houses of the legislature, and has gone nowhere in 2 years. So there's been a lot of oxygen spent on ethics reform, but quite frankly, I haven't seen enough evidence that neither house has been willing to really bite the bullet and do what's best for our state.
We've heard Joe Spector and Bill Mahoney, a couple of reporters, Karen DeWitt, our Albany Bureau correspondent, who've been talking about the way this could be structured, the proposals in recent weeks. And one example is that if you are making less than $5,000 in outside income, then you don't have to disclose. And that doesn't sound like a lot of money, but it turns out that if you have many, many different people or different sources deciding to bundle, say, $4,500 a piece from a bunch of different sources, then it can add up, and technically, you don't have to report it. That's how you can make a lot of money in outside income and still not report it. Is that a legitimate concern?
Well, of course, and I know I'm going to sound a little bit like a broken record right now, Evan. It's because that's why we have to see how it is actually detailed in the budget bill and in the language. The language makes all the difference in the world about how it's put into law. And when you look at in print, when it's actually on a piece of paper, is when you can really determine what's good about it and maybe what's not so good about it. And when you really think about it, you know, it's not just about full disclosure. I mean, there are people that work in the state legislature that get paid on being a rainmaker. And what that means is that they're not necessarily representing a client per se, but they're getting paid to send business to their law firm. And part of that connection is the fact that they're a state legislator and steers business to their firm, which they get paid on, but they don't necessarily show up as their individual client. And again, that is one area that'll be interesting to see if that still, that opportunity still exists to do that, because people are being paid by their law firm for helping them get business, which is kind of what Shelley Silver was getting paid for in his law firm down in New York City, who was steering clients to the law firm, but they didn't show up as his clients. They just showed up as the law firm's clients, but yet got paid on the revenue generated by those clients. And I think that's a major gaping loophole that's existed for a long time, and that'll be interesting to how we'll evaluate that one example as we go forward.
All right, then last question. I'll let you go, Brian, then. Is that one specific way that you would, if you had a chance to shape all of the ethics reform and it was in your hands, is that where you would start? What's one specific that you would immediately put in place?
Well, I think that we should, me personally, I think that if you've, two provisions. One, you can't use your campaign accounts for criminal defense, and number two, that certainly as a legislator, from a standpoint of campaign finance reform, you can't use any campaign contributions for other personal uses, which I think would at least get away from the temptation of doing that.
That's Brian Kolb, Republican Assembly Minority Leader, taking the time to join our program today. Blair Horner from the New York Public Interest Research Group, does he have a point on rainmakers?
He's absolutely right, and I think it could be a gaping hole in the system. Again, and he's absolutely right about the language, right? You never know what's going to happen until you actually read the bills. But if the paradigm that's being articulated is that if you're a lawyer legislator and you have outside clients, you're going to have to disclose your outside clients. And then the question is, well, if you don't have outside clients and you're just a rainmaker, as Brian was mentioning, then what happens? Well, the governor says, well, you're going to have to disclose what services you provide to the firm. Well, what is that going to mean? It's going to say like strategic advice or management consulting. That doesn't help the public. The state of Alaska requires lawyer legislators to not only disclose their clients or what services they provide to the firm, but the number of hours they work for the firm. And if you're getting paid $200,000-$300,000 as a legislator, and you're working 3 or 4 hours a month to make that money, I think the public would rightfully want to focus in on that and demand more information. With the absence of the hours that an individual works allows the sort of counsel rainmaker loophole to stay in place with some additional disclosure, but not meaningful new disclosures. And so he's quite right that that's a hole, at least that's been in the previous iterations of the bill languages that have been published. And the rhetoric that has come out of it, we don't know if that gets tightened up or if the loophole continues to swallow the law.
All right, then here's the logical follow-up, and let me ask you and Catherine the same question, because Mark writes to the program, nothing wrong with making a lot of money, but can't we tell people that the rules are different in government, and if you don't like it, don't serve? What Mark seems to be asking is about being even firmer, telling people you can't have outside jobs. And I talked to a former state senator who did not want to be named, who told me in January, when he was a state senator, he stopped practicing, that it felt too incestuous, that it felt too easy to start pulling the levers of power or steering clients or using influence, and he decided he was not going to serve. You talk to plenty of other, as Blair calls them, lawyer legislators, and they say, I don't cross the line. I separate my work. But should we have a firm rule? I'll start with you, Blair. Should we tell lawyer legislators, can't do both? If you want to serve in the state legislature, you cannot practice law at the same time.
The short answer is yes. If they wanted to run for Congress, That's what would have, that is what would happen to them. We believe that that would make, that that solves the problem. Now, just as an additional fact, two-thirds of the state Senate and three-quarters of the state assembly, currently the membership in both houses, two-thirds of the state senators, three-quarters of the state assembly members, currently either have no outside employment income or a small amount that would fall under the congressional model. So most lawmakers don't have this conflict. But the small minority that do are the ones controlling the debate, and many of them are the ones that make the really big bucks.
Catherine, what do you think?
Well, I think also you need to look at the other professions that might have these kinds of conflicts. And I think the question with citizens is to know it. When I speak to groups about choosing your elected officials, when you listen to candidate forums, that might be a question you want to ask. Who are their donors? What legislation do they believe they will be supporting and advocating if they get elected? And to make those connections, it's not my place to make the connections for the citizens that are voting for candidates and for the elected officials, but I do think it's very important that citizens know.
Blair, do you get the sense when an attorney who is also a legislator tells you, I can separate both, I don't mix state business with my personal clients or with the firm's clients? Again, it feels cynical to even ask you, but should we trust that?
Well, I mean, here's the real moral sort of dilemma on this, right? If you're a lawyer, or as mentioned, any professional, you have a fiduciary responsibility to put the interests of your client ahead of your own. And you're also a legislator, where you're supposed to be looking out first and foremost for the needs of your constituents. Obviously, that creates a conflict.
Yes.
And yes, you can come up with the best internal structures in the world to try to wall that off. And my guess is the vast majority of professional slash legislators do that. But we have now seen enough problems that we believe, NYPIRG believes, that New York should just follow the model that the Congress has already set, which is you serve only one master when you are an elected official. No one has to be an elected official. If you want to be an elected official like the vast majority of them do now, you have to put real limits on outside income.
All right, Blair, thanks for taking the time. NYPIRG is the New York Public Interest Research Group. You're online where?
NYPIRG.org, NYPIRG.org, or you can follow me on Twitter at Blair Horner, one word, BlairHorner, Blair Horner, on Twitter.
And for those who have not followed NYPIRG or maybe not familiar with the acronym, what's the short definition of your mission, Blair?
Nonpartisan, not-for-profit. Government watchdog organization that works on a variety of issues, consumer issues, environment, health, higher education, and political reform.
I think in many ways this hour, Blair, has been a little difficult in that there's ostensibly a bill done, but that we're still waiting to hear a lot of the details. But assuming they don't change, I think we've covered a lot of ground, and we'll certainly follow back with you on this and other issues. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Blair Horner is the legislative director for NYPIRG. A couple more minutes in studio here with Catherine Smith from the League of Women Voters, the Rochester metro area. So where would you send people, Catherine? Does the League sort of collate ideas for people to check out, or is the League online? How would you tell people who want to know specific ideas and where the League wants to go with ethics reform? Okay.
League Online is LWV, League Women Voters. Locally, it's -RMA, Rochester metro area. The State League, which has many policy papers, and I recommend our policy papers to people. They're in what I guess you would say readable language for the citizen.
Sure.
We try not to use the legal language when we write the position papers. It takes us 2 years to write them. We write them locally. We take them to the state. We have a convention every other year, and that's how the policy papers get out there. They're all online. And that's LWV, LeagueOfWomenVoters.org. And it's very simple to follow the links and to get the exact policy paper you want that we have done.
You really do think it's important to not only tear down ideas, but to sort of build up constructive ideas. And sometimes the marketplace of discussion gets bogged down a little bit with what people don't want, as opposed to what they do.
We do find that. And the what we are seeing, and we've seen a lot in the last 5 years, is when that happens, when people are surrounded by what I call headline news or social information through the social media, and it's just because we're in transition. I'm fully appreciative of that. But I think we do need a little more in-depth. We do need nonpartisan reporting of things, and the league always tries when we testify before the Assembly and the Senate, the executive hearings, is to give action, is to tell citizens what they can do. And we're not seeing that, and the evidence we have is the low voter turnout.
Well, I know your efforts not only to get people to vote, but to do it in a way that is engaged, that is informed, I think. And I appreciate that. Thank you for coming in and representing the League of Women Voters. It's always nice to talk to you. And I'm sure we'll have plenty more to talk about going forward.
I think
forward.
This afternoon and this evening will be of great interest to anyone that listens to your program.
Yes, Evan, indeed.
And we're very appreciative of your program and keeping the local people informed.
Well, thank you. Catherine Smith with the League of Women Voters. And she's exactly right. There's a lot coming up this afternoon, this evening, this week. They always want to get the budget done by April 1st. So even though last night we got that announcement that it's done, as Karen DeWitt told you, let's wait to see exactly what's in and what's out. Short break, very different second hour. We're talking about getting published and a breakthrough, a debut novel of remarkable success. We're going to talk to Boris Fishman, his fictional novel about Holocaust reparations. That's next.